Welcome to We Mentor Mondays podcast with Nancy. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery. Learn something new from our stories today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy. We're in Stevie Ray's home office studio in Burnsville, Minnesota, and we're here for a second mentoring session. And just for a brief reminder, Stevie Ray is a corporate speaker and trainer across the country. He's been doing this a long time, over 25 years, and he's the co-founder of Stevie Ray's Improv Company in Minneapolis. And in our last podcast mentoring session, Stevie Ray shared some really nice techniques for those who are very stressed out in social situations. And I think your book, Quick Thinking for Any Situation, would really be helpful for people to read.
It's a manual, not a descriptor, which I mean, it's filled with hands-on exercises. So it's not, it has a lot of background information,
but
it also says, if you want to do better in front of an audience, do these few exercises. If you want to manage a team better, do these exercises.
Yeah.
If you are dealing with a difficult situation and you're freezing up, do these exercises. So it's categorized in that format.
I see. Well, that's excellent. And I think that, with the degree of social anxiety, I mean, it's more common than we think.
Well, that's because the brain is wired in a way that we often ask it to act differently than it naturally does.
Through our belief system?
Well, first of all, the brain is wired. Neurologists will tell you that the brain has not changed one bit since the hunter-gatherer stage of evolution. That leaves a lot of processes set in place.
Yeah.
One, it is accustomed to a circle of about 30 other people, because that was the size of the average tribe or social group back in hunter-gatherer times. So you start getting too many people around you and you start to freak out a little bit. There needs to be some categorization, like these are my close circle of friends, these are my acquaintances, and everybody else is just somebody out there. And most people will tell you, I only have a few close friends and then a circle of acquaintances and that's it.
Yeah.
That's not unique to one or two people. That's the way the brain is wired. And so if you get into a work situation, by the way, which has a lot of people, some business analysts will tell you that any department within a company that's larger than 30 has a difficult time operating well, because our brain starts to freak out with more than 30 people around it.
Oh, that's so interesting to know.
And it also is not wired for change. Change is antithetical to calmness and contentment and productivity. If you do one thing really well a lot, the brain calms down and you just do that one thing. Because throughout history, that meant you ate. You were able to hunt the same way every time. You were able to gather food the same way. It worked well for us. Now, the problem with that is that over time, if you don't change, you'll die.
Yeah. Well, and the pace of change.
The pace of change is what throws us off.
Yeah.
It's got to be introduced the right way. It has to be managed the right way. And there has to be the right amount of it. If you get too much change all at once or too consistently, it just throws you into a tizzy.
Yeah, right.
So it's managing that.
Yeah.
That's why people in the workplace will say, why do we have to do it differently? We just got used to this way.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's necessary to throw a wrench in things and move on.
Yeah.
Other times, just slow down a little bit and let things settle.
Yeah. Take it step by step.
Mm-hmm.
So in our first session together, also, you talked about Viola Spolin as kind of the improv genius.
She's one of a handful, yes.
Yes, and that improv was kind of developing during the 20s and 30s?
Yeah, during the 30s. Another major figure is right here in Minneapolis, Dudley Riggs, who founded the Brave New Workshop. He had an entirely different approach. He was a circus performer his whole life, and his family were trapeze artists and tightrope walkers and that type of thing. And in the old days, the circus would shut down in the wintertime and everybody would go get a job.
Yeah.
He, during the winter, had a vaudeville troupe, and they were a comedy vaudeville troupe. They toured the country with comedy sketches. Well, in the old days of vaudeville, you got heckled a lot because the audiences were pretty rowdy.
Yeah.
And Dudley, I worked with him for quite a few years in the early 80s, and he told me that every club owner of a vaudeville club had a formula for a good show. A singer, a dancer, a stripper, and a comic. That's a good show.
Okay.
And he said our troupe would always follow the lady with the tassels. And they could not figure out how to get the audience to stop heckling them. One day, Dudley said, why don't we actually include what they say in our show and invite them to heckle, but use that? And everybody thought he was crazy, which is usually the earmark of a good idea.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks it's nuts. So they brought out a steamer trunk full of hats and coats and glasses and feather boas and set it on the stage. And they would say to the audience, thank you for having us here in Cleveland. Can you tell us who was the most hated person in town? It was usually the mayor or the chief of police or some person in authority. They would say, we give you a day in the life of the mayor. They would dive into that trunk and put on hats and glasses and coats, and then they would make up something. And it became a hit. And Dudley thought, well, maybe I've hit on something here. And he kept working that style. He had heard of the term improvisation being used somewhere else in the country. Most likely he was hearing about what was going on in Chicago at the time or California. But he said, I don't want to use that word. Improvisation is a jazz musician's term. So he called it Dudley Riggs Instant Theater Company because he said, that's what we're doing, instant theater. Oh. And he got... they traveled around the country, and one winter, his agent said, I wasn't able to get you any work. Your troupe has no tour. He didn't know what to do. So they were in New York. He rented a vacant storefront in New York to rehearse his troupe just to keep them working.
Sure.
People walking by the street started looking in the window and watching them. And then they started offering to pay money to watch the rehearsal. So he thought, well, let's do something about this. And he booked them at he booked them at a local club, and it became a hit. One of the most famous theater critics of the time, Walter Kerr, he was with what was called the Algonquin Roundtable, where all the famous critics would be. He came to watch the show for 3 weeks before reviewing it because he thought it was all set up. That cannot be made up on the spot. They must have a plant in the audience calling out the things they want to hear.
Oh.
After 3 weeks, he said, well, this is real. And when Dudley finally decided to settle down, he had toured through Minneapolis many times and loved it. So he chose here. Hmm. And so he's a major figure in improvisation. And he and the early founders of Second City used to get together. And whenever they toured through each other's town, they would get together and debate because they all thought the other one was doing it wrong.
There's a right or wrong to improv.
But Chicago has more marketing. So more people know about Second City than they knew the Brave New Workshop.
Oh, I see.
But he's just as important in the development of it as anyone.
Yeah. Well, and so are you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So tell us about your background. Like, how did you grow up? Did you grow up in Minnesota?
Rochester, Minnesota.
Okay.
So I had always grown up being funny because I couldn't play sports really well. And I wasn't really comfortable around girls. So I couldn't be smooth and I couldn't be athletic and my grades were average. So how am I going to stand out? Well, I became the funny one. And I also grew up being very much a teacher. Whatever I could teach somebody else how to do it. And
Oh, nice.
So I wanted to combine those two skills.
Yeah.
And I was actually on the path to becoming an elementary school teacher for many years in high school. Decided that wasn't the career for me. I went to college at Moorhead, Minnesota, Moorhead State University.
Yeah.
And I was going to be a speech pathologist, somebody to deal with speech problems in kids in schools. So I was still going to kind of be a teacher.
Yeah.
After 3 years of being in college, I decided I didn't want to do that either. Hmm. So there I am, my junior year. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
And my mother encouraged me to read a book called What Color Is Your Parachute?
Oh, yeah.
Classic book for people deciding what to do.
Mm-hmm.
My dad said, whatever you do, make sure it pays well, you know, because they grew up during the Depression. Get a job, get a pension.
Sure. And what field were they both in?
My father worked for IBM for his whole career, developing new products and that kind of thing. He was one of those classic rise through the ranks type. Started okay. as a repairman and worked his way up to executive.
Okay.
My mom was a nurse. And I read the book, What Color Is Your Parachute? And 5 pages into it, it was clear that I needed to do something that involved humor as well as educating somehow. Mm-hmm. So I actually created my own degree in college.
And they, at that time, they let you?
No.
Okay.
I had to fight for it.
Okay.
Because individualized programs were not a thing back then.
Okay.
I wanted to study humor. I wanted to study how it worked, the psychology of it, the theories involving laughter, that kind of thing. So I got 2 special advisors. We designed an entire curriculum. We petitioned the University Board of Directors to accept the program.
Was this in the late 60s or early 70s?
This is late 70s.
Late 70s.
And, okay. They said, okay, well, if you want your own program, young man, you're going to work twice as hard as if you were going to get a standard BA or BS. Hmm. So it was a very difficult program. It was titled The Theory and Performance of Comedy.
Oh.
Probably a more accurate title would be The Psychology of Humor.
But okay.
There you go.
Yeah.
I had to write a major dissertation on the classic and modern theories of humor, comparing theories all the way back to Aristotle up to psychology today, that kind of thing.
Oh, I bet that really helped you to really understand.
It was fascinating.
Yeah. And I'm sure some of the content is in some of your books.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That you've built on.
And now that they're studying the brain in ways they couldn't ever before, it's becoming even more apparent what humor can do for the intellect.
Oh,
so, and then I left college. I worked in a few clubs. I did improv and stand-up and toured the road and worked for Dudley Riggs for 5 years and then went back on the road and eventually took over a club with Pamela Main, my business partner. And then the club owners of that club wanted to get out of the business, so we took over. They sold the business to us, and Stevie Ray's Improv Company was born in 1989, and that's what we've been doing ever since.
Oh, excellent. And you've moved locations a bit?
Yeah, we at first wanted our own theater, and so, because that's what everybody does.
Yeah.
And so we had a couple of different locations, and then after a while realized we were spending so much time and energy on just managing the building that we weren't doing what we were meant to do. Mm-hmm. So we decided to close the building itself, part of it, and have our operation work out of various venues.
Like Chan Hansen Theater. And
we were back and forth with them for years. We were at the Sheraton in Bloomington. We were other places. We always knew that Chan Hansen was a good fit for us because we played there for a couple of years in the early 90s. We actually approached them and said, why don't you just make this permanent and give us one of your 4 theaters? Because they have 4 theaters under one roof, and one was sitting, actually 3 were sitting vacant.
Oh.
And the directors, who really worked well with us, said, why, that we'd love that idea. But the owner at the time said, no, I just want to stick with musical theater because that's our brand. Well, year after year, we would go down there. We were the entertainment for every New Year's Eve at the Chan Hansen. So every New Year's Eve, we'd tug at their sleeve and say, hey, you got that space.
Yeah.
We're right here.
Yeah.
Finally, 1 year they called us, and that went on for like 18 years.
Oh, my word.
Because we were there
for
New
Year's. Talk about perseverance and persistence.
And we get a call one day, and the directors said, we bought it from the owner. The Chan Hansen is now ours. How soon can you get down here?
Oh, beautiful.
And I said, I've got a van. Let's pack it up. That was in 2010, and that's been our permanent location ever since.
Okay, nice.
That's where we do our shows as well as our regular public classes and that type of thing.
Okay. Oh, excellent. Wow. So that sounds like a beautiful way to live a life. I mean, has there been a lot of financial stress that goes along with
sure,
this?
Oh, sure, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody will tell you, if I knew then what I know now and that type of thing.
Yeah.
Well, when you're young, you'll jump onto a ship and start going.
Yeah.
And there were long periods of time where everybody got paid but us, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is the old cliches are true. Do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But also do what you love and the money will follow.
Okay.
That takes really trusting that this is what you're meant to do, so you have to do it.
Yeah.
And Also, what we use is a phrase called being professionally selfish. And it feels to some people like, well, you're just doing what you want. Being professionally selfish means that if you don't do exactly what you're meant to do, you will end up not serving your clients very well because you'll be mediocre at it.
Yeah.
So every now and then, Pamela and I sit back and say, are we doing what we want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And we do take the advice of those around us who say, you should try getting into this, that, or the other thing. And we say, yeah, you're right. We'd be good at that. But we never ask ourselves, do I want to do that?
Right.
You can get involved in things. You can be good at anything.
Yeah.
But not really good.
Yeah.
After a while, we'd say, we got involved in that because somebody else said it'd be a good idea. We don't want to do it.
Yeah.
So we'd drop it.
Sure.
And be professionally selfish and go right back to the things we are meant to do and keep our focus tight. That's when we best serve our client. That's when we do our best work. Then the money comes.
Yeah.
And you're doing what you love.
Yeah. So is that how you kind of overcame the difficulty when you weren't being paid, when you weren't paying yourselves?
Right.
Is that when you took that time to kind of retool and look at what are we doing? What's our purpose here?
Well, the funny thing is that the times when we were starting out and not making a lot of money were not the times that we were involved in projects we shouldn't have been involved in. There's a wonderful book called The E-Myth, which stands for the
Michael
Entrepreneurial
Gerber.
Myth. And he says there's a crisis point at companies. And a lot of times that crisis point comes when there's extreme growth. The times when we took a step back and said, are we really doing what we want to do, were not the times when we're not making money. It's the time we were making a lot of money.
Oh,
but we were being pulled 8 different directions at once.
Yeah.
We were stressed. We weren't as happy as we wanted to be doing what we did.
Mm-hmm.
So we made choices when things were really making a lot of money. We still pulled away from them and said, if it's not what you're meant to do, you will eventually be mediocre at it. And it will come back and bite you eventually.
Hmm.
So those are the times.
Yeah.
The times when we weren't making any money, that's when you're like a kid sleeping on a box going, but I'm making it.
Yeah.
You know? And you just kept putting one foot in front of the other.
Yeah. You kept at it. Kept refining your craft. And
yes. And we did not have what a lot of companies had. And that is, first of all, we didn't have a lot of financing. It was all on us.
Yeah.
And also, we didn't have one particular goal. Here is where we are going to end up no matter what. Because to us, that took away the ability to be flexible and change course and say what we tried not to be just blowing in the wind and fluttering along with whatever came. We also tried not to be stuck on one vision only.
Yeah.
And be open to what was brought to us by colleagues and advisors and things like that.
Yeah.
For instance, doing the corporate workshops.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned at our last podcast that came as a suggestion from one of our students.
Yeah, and that was perfect.
And very often, you know, if you don't follow the improv rule of yes and, a lot of people say, well, that's kind of fine. Go ahead. Just do your student thing. Be a student here. Let us run the show.
Yeah.
But we said, oh, good idea. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And let's give it a shot. If it's not something we feel we're qualified to do, we don't do it because we owe that to our clients.
Yeah.
If it's something we feel qualified, that's where the ideas come from.
Yeah.
And all the subjects of our corporate workshops started with communication skills. Then a client would say, can you help us with professional networking? And we took a long look at that and said, yes, the techniques we teach can help that. So we said, yes. Then presentation skills. Yes. Then team management. Yes. All of the things that we said yes to were things that were really suggested to us by other people.
Hmm.
So we had to keep our focus open
to
accepting that.
Yeah.
And we've said no just as often as we've said yes.
Yeah.
People have asked us if we can help with succession planning. No, we're not experts on that.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they would say, we really like working with you. Can you help us with something over here?
Yeah.
No, that's not our expertise. Let me turn you on to somebody who is.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
Well, you have to have a good moral compass about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't want to take money for something I can't actually commit to.
Yeah, and you know, it fits in with your thinking of you know, being professionally selfish.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're really committed to that, that means doing the right work.
Exactly.
Where you feel this is the connection here.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes the most sense. You build out from there.
And I tell you, when you go into a career like this, I mean, when I called home and said, I discovered my new major, I know what I'm going to study.
Yeah.
Imagine parents hearing, I'm going to study comedy. The phrase, what kind of a job are you going to get with that, was part of the conversation.
Right.
Well, I paid my own way through school.
Okay.
So I was beholding to no one.
Mm-hmm.
And
that gave you the freedom really to go after this path.
And also they were very supportive. I mean, after that first initial shock, they said, well, if that's what you want to do, we're going to support you in whatever decision you make. They've been that way about all of their children.
Oh, excellent. How big is your family?
There's four kids.
Okay.
And my parents.
Where are you? Where do you fall in the mix?
There's three boys, 1 year apart, and I'm smack dab in the middle.
Okay.
And then my sister is 10 years younger than me.
Okay.
So she came along 9 years after the youngest boy. The interesting thing is that everybody was worried because I was the one in the family without a salaried job.
Mm-hmm.
But recently one of my brothers said, you know, I finally realized you're the only person in the family who, one, wakes up every day liking what you do. You've never hated your job once. And that's unusual.
Yeah, it's very unusual.
And you're the only person in the family who can't get fired.
Yeah.
There's some kind of freedom there.
Yeah, right.
So you do go through some lean times, but I've never once felt like I needed a vacation.
Hmm.
And my financial advisor asked me, what age would you like to be when you retire? And I said, from what? If I had more free time, I would do more of this.
Yeah,
I'm not going to retire from this.
Yeah.
I might choose to do something else, but I know people who cannot wait to retire from their job. I couldn't imagine that kind of lifestyle.
Yeah, where they plan for decades.
Yeah, get me out of here.
When they're retiring. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, do you think the internet has provided an opportunity for people to take more charge of their lives?
Yes and no. I think it's given the impression of control.
Yeah.
And control itself is a myth. You kind of have to let go of a lot of that in order to be content.
Yeah.
And the internet has allowed people more options, not necessarily the best ones, because we are designed as social creatures.
Yeah.
The brain is wired to connect with other brains on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And the more you sit alone in an office with the internet as your companion, it doesn't help. When Facebook was first rolled out, happiness scores among the population actually rose, because when you are connected to like-minded, caring people in a social way, old friends, classmates, things like that, it calms you and it creates a sense of well-being.
Yeah.
Happiness itself is only fleeting. You shouldn't be really trying to be happy all the time.
Yeah.
You should really be content.
Yeah.
That's what brings well-being. So happiness scales rose, contentment rose, well-being rose, and then it started to nosedive, because on Facebook and Snapchat and Twitter and all these things, all people talk about is what's great. And you see them taking selfie pictures on vacation and on the beach and doing all these exciting things. So people started looking at their own lives, comparing it, and saying, my life sucks. Look at all these great things.
Yeah.
Well, nobody takes a picture of them arguing with their wife.
Right.
Say,
yeah, exactly.
Here it is on Facebook. My life is the same as yours.
Yeah.
So it went up for a while because of the internet, but now the internet is causing somewhat of a downturn in well-being.
Yeah.
Because of comparing.
Yeah.
And you're much better off hanging out with people face to face, having a free exchange of conversation, and that brings about well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. That feeds your heart. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I only go on Facebook once a day. I say happy birthday to people who are having a birthday that day.
Yeah.
Do a quick scan of news.
Yeah.
And the rest is just a lot of noise.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, are you married?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have kids?
I have a lovely wife and a stepdaughter who is now 12 going on 30. So she's going to skip all the years in between. I haven't won an argument in years. They have the same DNA. I've told them frequently, I don't need both of you in the same room because it's a duplicate.
Right.
Yes.
Oh, that's kids, right?
Preteen. Ha.
Now, do you limit her interaction on the phones?
Yes, we have I mean, she's a great kid because she has not reached the rebellious stage yet. She's actually the one that pushes for family time.
Nice.
Yes. And she values it a lot. And we'll say, do you want to get together with some friends? And she'll say, no, let's just hang out as a family.
Nice.
And then she, of course, wants sleepovers with her friends and that kind of thing. She's normal that way, but she's very intelligent. And that comes from being around adults instead of kids.
Yeah.
There's actually been research to show that only children actually have a more successful life than people with siblings because all that's modeled to them is adult behavior. So they've been shown to better get along with teams. They are better at negotiating a positive outcome for all involved because they see that's the way you're supposed to live.
Sure.
So yes, we try to do outdoor stuff and game stuff.
Yeah.
And then we let her chat on her iPod.
Yeah.
She doesn't have a phone yet, a cell phone. We say, yeah, when you're involved in a sport where you need to stay after school, then you get a phone.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's just another plan to pay for.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So we try to do as much active stuff as we can. Hmm. Play a lot of games in the car.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Car bingo and I Spy, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I Spy is kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got a only child who. Yeah, she's 14 now.
There was years of people assuming that only children are more spoiled and less able to work with others because they demand attention. Time magazine did a 30-year study on sibling comparisons, showed that only children are actually more successful because it's the opposite of what everybody assumed.
Yeah.
They negotiate better. They get along better. They don't have as many needs as far as pay attention to me because they already see that mom and dad demonstrate proper behavior. And so they model that. Hmm. Unless mom and dad demonstrate jerky behavior, then they'll model that.
Right. You know. Yeah. Interesting. All right. Well, this has been fantastic. I would love to have another session with you.
Okay.
And I just appreciate all that you've shared. You do exude being a teacher and passionate about your work. And it's really always a joy for Mike Abea, our sound engineer and photographer, and I to listen in on these conversations and actually hear the depth of people when they've been doing something for a long time, that if you're really in your right livelihood or you're really doing the selfish professional work, that you're really engaged in life really fully and that you're really passionate about what you do and you want to keep doing it.
I'm just tired of Mike constantly interrupting.
I know.
That's the problem.
Yeah, well, we've had to stop the tape so many times.
Oh, man, God. Yes. I mean, this is all edited, folks.
All right. Well, thanks, Stevie Ray, for being here. Thank you, Mike Abea. And I just am remembering I forgot to thank you our last session. So I'm going to thank you twice now. Thank you, our audience, for listening in and keep working hard. Keep working on yourself and keep doing the work that you love. I'll see you next Monday.